Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by David Streitfeld, who is the author of Western Star, The Life and Legends of Larry McMurtry. Larry McMurtry, of course, is the author of Lonesome Dove and a whole bunch of things. I frankly had not realized before sitting down to read and read this book and research him and catch up on some of the stuff I should have seen years ago, frankly. Very prolific screenwriter, novelist. Involved with many things that I have seen and loved over the years and just hadn't quite realized it. So, David, I want to thank you for emailing me to offer me to send this book to me because I have learned so much about Larry McMurtry that I had not expected to or did not even know that I wanted to. I appreciate it.
I'm glad I did.
So let's talk about Larry McMurtry in one very specific facet. And this has nothing to do with books, his novels, I should say. It has nothing to do with his novels. It has nothing to do with his movies. He was an inveterate book collector. He was loved books. He was a book hound. He would go around trying to track them down and tried to bring that love of books to his town, his hometown in Texas, to mixed results. I want to talk about Larry McMurtry, book person, first and foremost here, because this was really fascinating to me as a book hoarder myself. Is this how you guys kind of got hooked up?
It is how we met and it is how we bonded. But Larry, long before I came along, was nuts about books because in his small town in Archer City, Texas, in the 1940s, there basically were no books. There were no books. There was very little cultural stimulation at all. There was the movie theater, and there was radio, which somehow he never ended up listening to, and that was about it. There was no town library. There was barely a school library, and there was certainly no bookstore. There was a rack at the drugstore. And so he was an intellectual, spindly child, I think is the word. He was not cut out to be a cowboy, even though his father put him on a horse every day and had him round up the local cattle and horses. And so he wanted more than anything to escape. And the only real way to escape was books. And so he had very few. He read what was in the drugstore, and he got the idea very early that the more books, the better. And books would take him out of Archer City, and they would provide him with an education, and that actually happened. And so in later life, he thought, why stop here? I've got money now. I'm going to accumulate as many books as I can. I mean, as many books as I'd want to read if I lived until 200, 300 years old. And he put them in his town in Archer City. And I think psychologically he thought, if there's another kid that comes along like me and he has nothing to read, I will be there for him. A little of the notion of the catcher in the rye. I will be here to help these lost children, and I will have a bookstore, and they too will get out of miserable Archer City. This is kind of in his brain taking place in an alternate reality that does not account for cable television or the internet or anything that the kids in Archer City were really looking at. the kids in Archer City actually scorned the books, but it was still a powerful idea, and it drove him for decades, 30 or 40 years.
Yes, the as the sort of person who goes to bookstores and kind of goes through them, it is it's a very hopeful idea, but maybe not the most realistic, unfortunately. No, but the story of his being a book hound and a book collector is really interesting, because it does kind of I found it resonant in the same way that I found Lonesome Dove resonant, right? So Lonesome Dove is a movie that, or a book is a book that is about the end of the West and kind of what that means and how people adjust to it, and what the kind of end of the frontier means. And in the same way, he is the last of a type, right? He is this kind of book hound who's going, he's driving up and down the coast trying to find bookstores. He is going to different shops. He's creating his own bookstore. And just over the horizon, the internet is coming, which is going to kind of obliterate everything, not just in terms of attention sources, but also just in terms of how people acquire books, how they sell them, how they find them, which is, again, a sea change. It's a cultural sea change. It's a sea change of it's a change of the whole landscape.
Larry loved to write about the end of things. He was born looking backwards, I always thought. And he wrote about the end of small towns. He wrote about the end of movies long before most people were even thinking about the end of movies. He wrote about the end of ranching, at least as done by people like his father and his uncles, cattle ranching on a small scale. And he was very tuned in to what he thought was the end of books. And again, he wanted to pile up not just any books, but all the good books as a kind of defense against the coming book apocalypse. I actually think he was not right about that. I mean, in COVID, which happened pretty much as he was dying, people really rediscovered their love of the physical book, and they're pretty popular now, considering they were supposed to be all gone by now, if you believe the myth about the propaganda about ebooks and how they were going to destroy all in their path. Books are really popular again now, which probably would have pleased Larry, especially if people were buying books directly from him.
So let's talk about his early years, because again, I did not know much about McMurtry. I was coming into this very cold, and again, for a guy who I mostly knew as a chronicler of the West, to the extent that I did know him, it was really interesting to see that he fell in with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and that whole gang. It just feels like a very different vibe than a lot of what we saw with the Last Picture Show, Lonesome Dove. How did he? So, just talk a little bit about his early years. How did he fall in with that crowd? What was his relationship to that scene like?
He was one of those people who, without really trying, things happened to. And I guess another way to put it is he was very lucky, or maybe he helped make his own luck. His first novel, Horsemen Pass By, it got good reviews. It hardly sold at all. It sold 1,500 copies. But one day, a producer found it in a bookstore in, I guess, Hollywood, and said, this would be perfect for Paul Newman's next film. And took it home and got a script made. And within about a year, which is nothing in Hollywood, it became Paul Newman's next film, which was HUD. And the money from that helped support Larry's next two or three novels. So things like that happened to him all the time. He went to Stanford University to attend the writing school there. And Ken Kesey was another student at the school, and they became somewhat wary friends of each other. Ken was this kind of boisterous, charming, possibly slightly sinister leader. In another world, he would have been a cult leader, and bad things would have happened to the followers in his cult. But he really became this dominant figure in the early mid-1960s culture with his acid tests and his bus trip across the country, which was popularized in Tom Wolfe's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. So everything led to something else. Larry was a friend of Kesey's, as I said, and his house in Texas was a destination for Kesey's bus. And then, you know, that visit became legendary once everybody read about it from Tom Wolfe. Larry really didn't have to do much. It was the experience of a morning, and it was over. But people are still reading about it, whatever, 60 years later. That happened all through his life. Presidents read his book, and Ronald Reagan was a huge fan and invited him to the White House for a state dinner, and that happened to be the most famous state dinner. I think it was a state dinner, that's a technical term, but it was an important dinner where John Travolta danced with the Princess of Wales, and everybody there remembered it for the next, for the rest of their lives. So some people are just lucky and show up in all the right places at the right time. The obvious cliches here are like Zelig and Forrest Gump.
Sure.
Larry was a Forrest Gump of modern literature.
Well, and Kesey, of course, was is the author of
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
One Flew Over the... Thank you. Thank you. Kesey, of course, is the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which he wrote in the... in the seminar that that McMurtry was also in, right, in the same program, the same creative writing program at the same time, right? Well, they were they were working at the same time there, which is, again, as you say, kind of forced gumping through the literary scene. Is that's a fairly amazing place to find yourself at the same time.
Yes, although the world was a lot smaller then. That was probably the most famous writing class in history, considering what it produced and the writers that were in it. There were others even whose names we know today beyond the two of them. But also at that time, there were not a lot of creative writing classes in universities. So there was, you know, the one at Stanford and the one at Iowa. So if you were going to go to a university creative writing class, maybe the odds were a lot higher than that you would meet someone who was a great writer and would become famous.
Yeah. It's amazing stuff. So he writes the book that would become HUD, which is an enormous success. And he does not love HUD. He's a little taken aback by the film, right? I think that was the basic read on it
That's fair. The film takes a relatively minor character, the character of HUD, and brings him to the forefront, because if you want Paul Newman starring in your movie, you got to give him a big role. Larry didn't really like it, but for unusual reasons. Most authors do not like it when Hollywood changes their book around. Larry thought and would say publicly that his book was pretty weak, and he just wished Hollywood had made a better movie out of it, but the movie was pretty weak too. I should add that most people don't agree with that and think that it is a major film, but Larry was highly critical of it.
Yeah, that was really interesting to me, because I've always thought of HUD as a relatively important film, certainly in the career of Paul Newman, but also just generally, just as a relatively popular, fairly big hit. And yet, you know, I guess one of the things that you learn reading enough books about authors is that they are very rarely happy with what happens with their books. And sometimes for weird reasons, as we'll see a little bit later on with Brokeback Mountain and its author.
They're never happy, and that's probably why they go on and write another book. They're cranky, which makes them hard to live with, but it keeps them writing.
So, all right, let's move on to The Last Picture Show, which is, of course, it's an incredibly important picture in the kind of American new wave of the 1970s. Peter Bogdanovich's first big movie. You know, he had made one before this, a film called Targets for Roger Corman. But Last Picture Show kind of cements his place in the firmament. I think makes McMurtry a pretty important literary figure as well. That was big for him, right?
It was big for him, although as a movie, it did better than as a book. The movie kind of pulled along the book.
What was the response? There are two different responses here that are of interest to me. One is the general response to the film. And we can talk about that and kind of what that meant for the book. But the second, and I think you write about this quite a bit, is the response in the town, the response in his hometown and the town in which it is, you know, kind of set to the book, which was not quite as rapturous as in the critical press.
Right. The critical press was generally overwhelmingly favorable. There was someone who said it seemed to be true that this got the best reviews of any American film since Citizen Kane, which would have been what, 30, 40 years before. And it was, people said, the reviewers said, and the public turned out for it, a film for just about everyone, which is not what you would think of as a black and white film set in the past about a bleak Texas town. But my memory is the budget was about $1 million and it made about $30 million. And it got a bunch of Oscar nominations and it won at least two for Best Supporting Actress and Best Supporting Actor. So for a small budget independent film by a second time director, that was a huge hit. In Archer City, they always had mixed feelings about Larry. The film and the book is basically about a bleak town where, nevertheless, people are having sex all the time, either with each other or, especially in the book, with the local animals. And no solid citizen of any town is going to look at that with approval. And so there was a lot of pushback against Larry. And frankly, there's even some pushback against him still today, that you presented a portrait of what life is like here in small town Texas. That is not true, and we don't like you for it. It's not the majority view, but it's definitely out there.
Plus, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, plus the accusation is you're selling books, and we don't need books around here. They could only corrupt young minds.
Yeah. The feelings about McMurtry kind of throughout Texas are complicated throughout his life. I mean, he is kind of he is both seen as the chronicler of Texas, you know, in this time period, and is also, the sense I get from your book, not well liked by most of the people who are in that literary community in Texas. They are skeptical of what he is writing because he is often quite pointedly barbed about the state and the literature it has produced over the years.
I think that's fair. He was very ambivalent about Texas. He could never leave it for good, but he could never stay there without getting the urge to leave it tomorrow on the next plane, which he often did. I mean, most writers, most creative artists who hit it big leave their small town and move to New York City, where they can be finally understood and get a good dinner. And Larry certainly liked a good dinner, but he could never quite leave Texas. So that means both people who love Texas and those who hate Texas can find something in his work to support their views. And ambivalence, I think it probably drove him crazy, but it's a very powerful emotion for an artist. You end up writing about places in a complicated way. You don't just slam them or just talk about how great they are. You talk about the good things and the bad things.
Again, reading your book, the sense I get from your conversations with him and also some of the things he would do. For instance, he was asked, this is towards the end of your book, he's asked to write a chapter in a book about ecology or some such, and he writes about how much he hates trees. Right. And it just seems like that happens over and over again. He's asked to write the foreword for a photo book about rodeos, and he's like, rodeos are kind of silly. They're just, you know, they're showbiz. He seemed to revel in that sort of kind of puckish side of his personality.
I think that's true. I think he was, in a lot of cases, a contrarian. I don't think he did it on purpose. He really did feel that rodeo was A, boring, and B, stupid. And he had that view through his life for good reason, that rodeo is basically an art of people demonstrating how good they are on a horse. And in the real Texas, when you're on a horse, you are getting a job done. You're not demonstrating for a crowd how good you can do things. So he thought it was a false picture, which, you know, he was on a horse for much of his first 20 years. So he came by that honestly. But I do think also just being, you know, as an artist, he was not a cheerleader and certainly not a cheerleader for Texas. If he was, probably his work would have been forgotten by now.
Yeah, not being a cheerleader. It's funny because there's definitely, you could say, well, if you don't like the rodeo, you should just turn down the assignment. But this is also like, I will say as a writer, I very rarely turn down assignments just because I don't necessarily like the subject matter. That is the writer's number one thing is working. I need to work. This is work. I'll write it for you. Which is, again, feels very, very true to a conception of writers that is maybe kind of passing from the scene.
That was true. He liked to work. He liked to write, and he started every day, you know, before it was light, and worked on whatever was at hand. So he figured if you asked him to write about something like rodeo, in your book about how great rodeo was, don't be surprised if you got a piece saying rodeo wasn't that great. That's your problem.
It's very funny. I recognize a certain amount of that in almost every writer I know, which is pleasing. Let's talk about Lonesome Dove, because it is obviously his great work. It's the thing I think most people know him from and remember him from, and it's having a bit of a moment right now. I mean, we were discussing this over email before the show. It is, for some reason, continues to kind of pop up the Amazon charts. People are still reading Lonesome Dove. Absent our discussion of doing this episode, absent our discussion of your book, I had known several people who had talked about they had just started reading it because I myself was looking for an excuse to finally sit down and read it. And I was like, well, if I'm doing this episode, I should probably do that. Why has Lonesome Dove endured when so many other similar novels, award-winning works, long historical epics faded from the scene over the last years here?
I think the number one reason is that when he sat down to write this, which intermittently took 7 years, he was, despite how long it took, despite the fact that he said he got bored with it, despite interruptions, etc., he was in the zone. And if you spend a career writing, it can happen to any of us. There's a certain piece, a certain book, whatever, a topic where you start writing and it just comes out perfectly or as close to perfect as you can imagine. I don't know. I mean, it's never happened to me, but I have hopes. But for Larry, Lonesome Dove looks like, it reads like he sat down and dreamed the whole thing. It doesn't feel to its readers like a novel. It feels like they're falling into a dream, an experience. People always say, well, it was 850 pages, and I wasn't sure about that because nothing I've read has been longer than 100 pages, but it didn't feel like 850 pages. So I think that's the number one reason. People read it, they like it, and they recommend it to other people who also like it. I mean, I'm just astounded to read all the time on the internet, random people saying, this was the best book I ever read. And then there will be 20 comments after it saying, yeah, I felt the same way too. And I don't know who these people are. Maybe, you know, they read a book a week. Maybe they haven't read anything since high school. But they do genuinely like the book. And once you get enough of those, you get a word of mouth bestseller. There's plenty of other reasons. Taylor Sheridan, who is in many respects McMurtry's heir. I mean, he's working in the same sort of territory in Texas, is a huge fan of the book and says he has read it 30 or 40 times. It changed his whole life. It made him a filmmaker. He named his son Gus after the hero. I mean, if you read what he said and he was not Taylor Sheridan, you would say this guy is just completely over the top. So that's another reason. I'll mention one more, which is a slightly darker reason. Lonesome Dove is a celebration of a lot of things. It's a celebration of friendship. It's a celebration of getting on your horse and riding off and discovering open country. It's, you know, very funny. It's got a lot of twists and turns that readers like to follow, but it's also a fairly dark story of conquest. And it's about two men who have spent their life, as they say, making the West safe for bankers and insurance salesmen. And they basically had to kill everybody who made life more interesting. All the outlaws, they killed all the Native Americans. And at this point in their life, they're starting to have real regrets about it. And they say, well, maybe we fought for the wrong side. Maybe we did the wrong thing. And without getting too political about this, it's interesting to me that this novel is once again extremely popular at a moment when America, or at least part of America, is dreaming of empire again. The book originally came out in 1985 and was a huge hit. And that's when Ronald Reagan was there talking about the American empire and saying, we don't have to be ashamed of anything we do. And, you know, we need to take charge of our destiny as Americans. And the book is both a commentary on that and has mixed feelings about it. But it would take a greater literary critic than I to really get to the roots of this and how reading that book is a response to the current political scene, I would say.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, without getting into everything happening in, for instance, Iran, you know, right now, it is kind of interesting to think about. One of the reference points that comes up in your book and that I had heard before I read it was that it's kind of like Gone with the Wind. Okay. And it was interesting when I was reading, finally sitting down to read the novel, you know, earlier this year, and I'm reading it and I'm like, wow, this is a much darker story. This is not a celebration of the people are dying horribly all the time in this book. You know, people who we like are dying horribly all the time in this book. It is not celebratory in any real way, except as a kind of idea of going forward and doing something that hasn't been done. But that contradiction itself is kind of the heart of the book. You write, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot here. But you write in the chapter titled "The Making of Lonesome Dove Part One," the cowboy flourishes through contradictions. He is quick with his fists and deadly with his six shooter, but disdains violence. His life is close to the earth and its creatures, but he has a spiritual heir. He respects property, but has only his horse and his gun. He works to create a better civilization and declines to join it. End quote. And that really is the heart of this story. It's about people who are creating civilization that they hate. And right. I find that fascinating. That is a fascinating contradiction of the sort that you don't often see.
Right. I think once again, Larry was ambivalent. None of this was planned. He just sat down and typed. He was the least conscious writer I've ever heard of. So it just all came out of his subconscious, and he didn't try to say, well, I'm writing about imperialism here or defense of imperialism. He didn't say any of that. It just came out. But I think it came out of his ambivalence. And that's what, you know, when people reach a certain age, middle age, they start thinking, well, you know, my life wasn't exactly the way I thought it should be. Maybe I should have done this, or maybe I shouldn't have done that. And that's essentially what the people in Lonesome Dove are talking about. If you want to read it that way, if you don't want to read it that way, it's a stirring story of adventure where, yes, a lot of people get killed, but you, the reader, you know, I was going to say you, the reader, don't end up suffering that fate. I don't know. Maybe you do. A lot of people feel destroyed at the end of the book, but it's still only a novel, so they could recover from it. I don't know. It's hard to talk about that novel like it's hard to talk about most great literature, because it contains something and it also contains its opposite.
You absolutely see that again within the character of the cowboy himself, this figure of settlement that also resents being settled, is just really interesting. And of course, it's hard to discuss all this absent the context of the television series. So the miniseries comes out in 88, 89. And it is an enormous hit. I think the Nielsen's were something like 44 million, something in the 40 million
right,
range.
Right.
Which is probably an order of magnitude more people than have ever read the book. Or I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe this is a popular enough book that it gets closer. But it's almost certainly more. That in and of itself has kind of helped define the idea of Lonesome Dove. This TV series, this enormously popular TV series starring Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones, big movie stars, that I think downplays some of those contradictions. It's funny, I watched the series for the first time as well this last month. And it is really interesting. It is really interesting to watch it as both an artifact of 1988 or 89, whenever it came out, and also just as a thing that is working against itself. Because anytime something serious or somber happens, the music that is playing over it is so ridiculously jaunty that it's like, well, what are we doing here? What is this show? What are we watching here? Because again, there's all of the beats, all of the story beats are functionally the same, but there's just this kind of like playful clip clop music over so much of it that I was like, what is happening? This is wrong. Something has gone wrong here.
That's interesting. I would probably be stoned in Texas for saying this, but I feel the miniseries has not lasted well. It is too redolent of the 80s, and you kind of watch it now as a period piece from the 80s about, you know, the 1870s. And I don't know if that many people will be watching the miniseries in 10 years or 20 years, whereas I'm pretty sure they'll still be reading the novel. It softened the vision, it softened the ambivalence of the novel even more, and Larry felt people didn't get the ambivalence of the novel, so he gave up all hope with them learning anything from the miniseries. People love it. They love the acting, which is superb, but I don't know if they feel there's a deeper meaning in it.
Were the follow-on novels kind of a response to that? Because I feel like certainly Streets of Laredo gets very dark very quickly. Darker than I think Lonesome Dove, I think it's fair to say. Did it feel like he was kind of pushing back against that, or was it just like, well, this is where the story's going?
He was definitely consciously pushing back against it as much as he was a conscious writer in anything he did. He was saying, you didn't get it before, so I'm going to really make sure you get it now. But somewhat, yeah, I think the three subsequent novels, they're very good. They're very readable. They form a set with the original, but the original is the Mount Everest that the other three are, you know, the lower peaks. And the three later novels were also all made into movies, which are very good and very watchable, but they don't really transcend their origins either. So there's the original novel, Lonesome Dove, and then there's all of the print spinoffs and the film spinoffs that only the more dedicated fans end up seeing.
Yeah.
Or reading.
It's just interesting. And the other thing is, of course, this was a huge success. He made an enormous amount of money on these. The sequels in particular, I think you mentioned that he was getting $2 million a book, right, for the sequel. Like that's a crazy number to contemplate. But it is very funny. You know, his love of books and his love of caviar ate into that pretty quickly. Him being a caviar fan, that cracked me up. I don't know why. That was very funny.
He loved to live the high life. He refused to stay in any hotel that was less than 4 stars because he knew it would be a miserable experience.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about his work in Hollywood, because he has written a number of screenplays. A number of them have been produced. He's done, you know, some script doctor work, but I think his crowning achievement, what he, you know, winds up winning an Oscar for, is Brokeback Mountain. How did he get into Brokeback Mountain? How did his involvement there come about?
It came about pretty much by accident. His writing partner, Diana Ossana, read the story as it was published in The New Yorker and said, "This will be a great movie." And Larry had not read a short story in 50 years, but grudgingly agreed to read this one. He also thought it was great, and they contacted the writer, Annie Proulx, who was an admirer of some, not all, but some of Larry's works. And so they quickly made a deal and wrote a screenplay relatively quickly. It took, whatever, 4 more years to get it made, because actors and studios just thought, there's no way in the world the public is going to go for this story. And that was probably true for, you know, if they had done a poor job on it. But luckily, the movie, the acting, the script, all of the work, the music was so good that it served to win people over.
Yeah, the box office, I was just looking it up. I had looked it up, but I wanted to make sure I had the number right. $178 million worldwide, which is a staggering number for a movie that was produced by the independent arm of a major distributor, is produced by Focus Features. You know, it was made for only $14 million, something like that. And it deals with a subject matter that is, again, not considered to be super mainstream friendly. You know, it's a period piece. First of all, it's strike number one, gay cowboy, strike number two, you know, there's all sorts of things kind of lined up against it. And yet it's an enormous hit. It's a critical favorite. It does huge numbers. And then, of course, one of the legacies of the film is not winning Best Picture, losing to Crash, which is just one of these like kind of classic, you know, Oscar snub, Oscar tragedy type stories that gets trotted out every year. What was Larry's response to the success of the film? You have some very funny stories of him pinging you on the campaign trail. Just be like, "Oh God, I got to go to another one of these things."
Right. He said, as long as he was winning, it was bearable. If you're losing, if you're the one not getting the award that night, it just, he would have, I don't know, killed himself. He had issues all the way along as an artist with everybody involved in this. For instance, he could not understand Hollywood's reluctance to take this on. And he was very frustrated by it. Then finally, Ang Lee did take it on. And Ang Lee was a serious and accomplished director at that point. You could argue one of the best directors around. And Larry, instead of being grateful, was absolutely positive Ang Lee was going to screw it all up. And he was not on the set. He said he was barred from the set, and he would send letters and telegrams complaining about what he thought was going on and how he thought they were screwing it up. None of which was actually true, but I guess that's the degree to which he was invested in this. And he knew that the way Hollywood works is once the director gets the film, they can change things around. And he was worried, for instance, I don't know how serious a worry this was, but that Ang Lee would take the two men and make them into two women instead. And that would be a more saleable film. And said, well, if Ang Lee wanted to do that, you could just destroy all my work and make a different film. So he was pretty unbearable, I'm sure, to everyone who knew him during that period. And then Ang Lee makes a great film, and he was in tears at the screening and literally fell into Ang Lee's arms. And Larry said, and I'm sure Lee felt the same way, that Lee wasn't sure that Larry was going to either hit him or hug him because of their past history. But Larry loved the film and hugged him, and it went on to its great success. But it illustrated for Larry and for probably half, many of the people in Hollywood, just how chancy all of this is. It could have been a horrible film. It could have been never made at all. And when Hollywood had a great success, at least in that era, it was just something, it was a miracle. And you could not quite explain how. You could take the same director, the same actors, the same script, and do things slightly differently, and it would be a disaster. Luckily, in this case, it was a miracle.
It holds up. It holds up better than Lonesome Dove, the miniseries. I can say that much. That's a stone cold fact. That was pretty much everything I wanted to hit on here. There's so much more. Again, the name of the book is Western Star: The Life and Legends of Larry McMurtry, by David Streitfeld, and you should check it out. If you are interested in McMurtry, I would also recommend reading Lonesome Dove, of course, and, you know, watching The Last Picture Show and all that. David, I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about the your book or Larry McMurtry or just life in general. What should we have discussed that we did not?
I don't know if we should have discussed it. It's just something, it's a notion I got recently that I'm going to start thinking about. Larry did a tremendous amount of work over 60 years. I mean, there's 30 plus novels, some of which are really long. There's a bunch of screenplays. I mean, there's as many as, I think, 100 screenplays, the vast majority of which were never made. And so I find it hard to think about that much work, and you can't expect a viewer to think about that much work or to go through all of Larry's novels. It's just impossible. So I try to focus, and I would encourage others to focus, on the best material and how to think about it, in unusual ways. But what I'm trying to say here is two of Larry's lasting achievements, which we've talked about here, are The Last Picture Show, about a dying Texas town, and Lonesome Dove, about the great days of Texas and how they went out and conquered everything and had a great time doing it, had a great time killing everybody else. What I'm interested in now is relating those two together and how we went from the conquest of Lonesome Dove and the excitement then, and these were the great days, according to the participants, to, in, you know, a generation, in 50 years, we go to the misery of Last Picture Show and how everybody in town can't stand it, and no one has dreams at all, and they're suffering, and the only thing to do is get out. This also has comparisons or points of contrast with what is going on politically in America today. And so I guess I'm planning my own little private film festival where I put Lonesome Dove and then The Last Picture Show back to back and see how one led perhaps directly to the other. And, you know, how they depict a situation, a part of America that is a less sympathetic part of America, and how we can use that to understand where we are politically and culturally in America in 2026.
Let me ask, I might cut this depending on what you say here, but do you want to talk about the documentary at all?
Sure.
You want to? Okay.
My brother, who lives in Texas, so he's a Texan, and who makes documentaries for a living, and I went up to visit Larry in 2007, and with his permission, filmed him. And he had a lot of interesting things to say, and we caught them on camera. And then he got, as Larry tended to do, weirder as the day went on and more cryptic. And finally, by the end of the day, just shut the whole project down, saying, "You want me to talk about Hollywood? I can't talk about Hollywood, because if I do, they'll get mad at me in Hollywood, and I won't get any more work, and I won't be able to stand that." So we stopped what we were doing, but we kept the tapes, and now 20 years later, we've resurrected them, and they show Larry in his element on his ranch house, talking about himself, his family, his history. And we went out and filmed a bunch of other people. His widow, Faye Kesey, his brother, Charlie, various experts, various writers in the New Texas, and tried to assemble a portrait of him that people could watch. They don't feel like actually reading a book or listening to a book. There's never been a documentary on Larry because he was too elusive to allow that to happen. And we're looking forward to having this be the first one. We should be done shortly, a month or two.
And we will definitely keep an eye out for it. David, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.